American Timelines is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. For more information, go to queencitypodcastnetwork.com.
So now I'm obsessed with time. Come on, tell me about the time. Had it all in my head tonight. Had the time of my life. When the words all come down, like blues on Tuesdays come down.
Throw it all. Welcome to another episode of American Timelines.
And I am Marky Post, former star of TV's Night Court.
That's Joe.
I'm Marky Post.
And this is the American Pop Culture History podcast that brings you exciting, nostalgic events from pop culture history year by year. And
year by year.
This is part three of 1973.
That's right. My name is actually Joe. It's not Marky Post. I was trying to pull the wool over is what I was trying to do to the listeners. I like to kid the listeners.
It wasn't even a good one.
It wasn't? Marky Post? No, it wasn't a good one.
It wasn't a good one at all.
You know, I had one all ready and set up, and then I wasn't ready to start the podcast yet, so I just went with the old standby, Marky Post.
What's the first thing that we're going to talk about?
Well, this is the third episode of 1973. We're just spreading this. We just love 1973, apparently, because we're spreading out to three eps. Can I say eps?
If you want. You sound like a dipshit.
Oh, yeah. Well, cool, Jay. I swing an ep in my Jeep.
All right.
Know what I'm saying?
All righty.
Nah, mean.
You're a white person.
You take that back.
Okay, what's first?
Well, we're going to start with a movie. And we're going to do something different this episode. We have a special guest. A special movie expert nerd guest that
he loves birds.
Yeah, he loves birds and movies, and he has red cheeks, and he loves beer, and he has like giant mittens for hands. But if you've ever, if you're a loyal listener, if you listen to every episode, then you've heard us maybe talk about him occasionally. The things we've said about him is one, he texts me every time an episode comes out to either talk about the movies that we've mentioned and. Basically be a know-it-all. Be like, oh, yeah, I've seen that movie 15 times. I know more about it than you. And he also is the guy we talked about one year when we talked about how pricey VHS tapes were when they first came out.
We thought, oh, my God, he must have spent hundreds.
Yeah, because he's known for having every movie. Like, if you ever want to borrow a movie, just go to Muppet's house. And Muppet, did I already say his name was Muppet?
No, just now.
So this is what his name is. And you'd go to his house, and he'd have every VHS, and you'd borrow it. He was like a video store. And then It was real sad when DVDs came out and VHS was officially gone. Like, we're like, what is that poor guy going to do? Yeah. And so he did the same thing with DVDs. He did a million DVDs, and then Blu-rays came out. And now he's like, fuck all this collection shit. So now he just, I'm not sure what he does. But
we'll have to ask him when he appears.
He's going
to
be our guest today. And so he's standing by, and we're just going to splice him in when we get to that. So in this first one, we'll just go right ahead. And it's the third highest grossing movie of 1973 was American Graffiti.
Okay. I get that one confused with The Last Picture Show.
What? Why?
I get that movie and The Last Picture Show confused.
I'm not sure what The Last Picture Show is. You're not talking about Rocky Horror Picture Show.
No, I'm talking about The Last Picture Show. Which one has Cybill Shepherd?
Cybill Shepherd is in
The Last Picture Show, I think.
I think she might be in this, too.
See, this is when Muppet needs to be here.
Yeah,
we'll ask him.
We'll ask him. We'll bring him in here and we'll ask him. But this is the one with Richie Cunningham.
Yes.
Remember, it looks just like Grease. But this one is an American coming-of-age comedy film directed and co-written by George Lucas, starring Richard Dreyfuss, Ron Howard, Paul LaMotte, Harrison Ford, Charles Martin Smith, Cindy Williams. Remember it? We saw Shirley from Laverne and Shirley making out with Richie Cunningham. Opie Cunningham, as we call him, Candy Clark, Mackenzie Phillips, Bo Hopkins, and Wolfman Jack.
And
Suzanne Summers and Joe Spano also appear in the film. So we watched the trailer to this.
That's a lot of stars.
Amy saw Shirley making out with Ron Howard. She was like, oh, is this where they got the idea for Laverne and Shirley and Happy Days? Was it tied to this at all? And I said, I have no idea. But we'll ask Muppet when he gets on.
I thought maybe you had researched it.
No, I didn't.
Okay.
And Muppet's my research. I'm bringing him on. We'll ask him all these questions. And whether he knows or not, We're going to just go with whatever he says is right. It's set in Modesto, California in 1962. The film is a study of the cruising and rock and roll cultures popular among the post-World War II baby boom generation. The film is told in a series of vignettes telling the story of a group of teenagers and their adventures over a single night. Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, please welcome Muppet.
Hello.
Yeah, there's Muppet.
There's a sexy Muppet voice.
Hello, sexy
Muppet. Hey.
Well, Muppet, the third highest grossing movie of 1973. Muppet, are you familiar? Off the top of your head?
Dirty Mary, Crazy Larry.
No. Aww. On Saturday, August 11th, 1973, American Graffiti was released in the U.S.
Uh-oh. And I was saying, I always get this mixed up with The Last Picture Show in my mind, and I don't know why.
I can kind of see it. It's that they're both about like high school people,
50s and that,
beginning their new lives.
True. Which one had Cybill Shepherd in it?
Last Picture Show.
Okay.
Yeah, so not this one, dummy.
Jeez.
Yeah, so we went through the stars of this one, and we watched the trailer like we've been in other ones, and it led us to a stupid question that we'll just go ahead and just have you answer for us.
Yeah.
Since you're the expert, the nerdy movie expert.
Nerd.
Does that mean we watched the scene where Cindy Williams, who we all know as the lovely and talented Shirley on Laverne and Shirley, making out with Ron Howard?
Hot.
And so Amy's question was, well, is this tied into Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley some way? Like, is that
how they got the idea or something for Happy Days and Laverne and Shirley?
It is tied to Happy Days. Like, Happy Days isn't exactly a continuation, but it's sort of like kind of like the way Friday Night Lights, the show and the movie are.
Oh, really? That close?
What? Anyway, there's no Richie Cunningham in American Graffiti.
No, but Richie Cunningham and Ron Howard in the movie are, like, kind of basically the same character.
They're kind of the same. Well, who's Chachi, then?
Chachi came later.
Unfortunately, there is the Chachi.
Harrison Ford's not Chachi?
God, I wish.
Who's the Pat Morita character?
Probably Cindy Williams.
What about Laverne? Who plays Laverne?
Richard Dreyfuss.
There you go. Now, in real life, Laverne and Shirley is a spinoff of Happy Days, right?
Yeah, I believe it is.
Yeah, I think so too.
I don't know how they're related exactly.
I think they lived up the street or something, I want to say.
I think Cindy Williams banged Richie. I mean, I think Shirley banged Richie, I think.
I think you might be right.
Before
so Kong. In the, it's weird, in the universe of Happy Days that aliens exist.
Oh, yeah, because Mork, right?
Yeah.
Oh, is that another? Is that a spinoff?
Yeah, Mork.
I'm confusing shows. I'm confusing Pam Dauber and Cindy Williams. I apologize.
Oh, you are,
I was
going to
say.
No, I think. Because,
no, they can't be because Mork and Mindy was modern day, not 50s, dummy.
Are you sure? Mork and
Mork
Mindy.
Mork and Mindy did not take place in the 50s. She had a Jeep, for Christ's sake.
They had Jeeps in the 50s?
No, they didn't. Not those kinds.
Yeah, they had Jeeps in the 50s.
Just in the Army.
See, Jeep in the 50s. Boom, I got some.
Just in the Army.
Mork and Mindy is a spinoff of something, though. I'm pretty sure that he showed up with that giant egg with Jonathan Winters.
No, he not.
On Happy Days.
No, that did not happen on Happy Days.
Oh, it's on something. Anyway, okay. Is there
with
anything
Jonathan
else?
Winter.
Is there anything else about American Graffiti you need to tell us, Mups?
Wolfman Jack's in it.
Wolfman Jack, yeah, Suzanne Summers.
Is it good? Is it any good?
It's pretty good. It's more of a nostalgia piece for people who grew up in the 50s.
Like the Big Chill.
I kind of like Dazed and Confused better just because it's closer, even though I wasn't in high school in the 70s, it's kind of closer to what I knew.
One thing I think about American Graffiti, I'll just say it, is I think it's one of these movies that's you're supposed to, like movie fans are supposed to love it, so they just do. But it's not that good. I watched it. I didn't think it was that good.
Yeah.
It was dumb.
Yeah, I think it was probably good in its time, but it doesn't speak to our generation as much.
And I don't like Harrison Ford not without a whip and without a
Harrison
a
Ford
gun.
Was in it? I didn't remember
Harrison
that.
Harrison Ford's in it, and he's not even dressed like Indiana Jones.
Well, of course not.
Yeah,
and he's
it's
not wearing a
gross.
Vest. Like, that dude should either wear a vest or a hat, a fedora, and that's it.
All right.
Okay, next movie.
Next movie.
Okay, we're going to move on to Friday, December 19th, 1970. No, Friday, October 19th, 1973.
Mm-hmm.
The fifth top grossing movie of 1973. You want to give it a guess there, Mups?
The Conversation.
The Way We Were.
Oh, yeah, I never saw that.
You never saw The Way We Were?
Nope.
Well, it's a
shock.
Oh, well, let me school you a little bit on some movies, you bitch.
I mean, as much as I love Barbara Streisand and all.
How many Barbara Streisand movies have you seen?
At least you knew that. Like, if somebody would, if I hadn't seen the trailer, I would never know that Barbara Streisand
and Robert Redford
were in this. I wouldn't know. I don't know that
I've seen a single Barbara Streisand movie.
So my friend Don McAllister, who you met at the pub crawl, was going to be very upset.
Upset.
He is a huge Barbara Streisand fan.
Me and him will get together and we'll watch Yentl.
Yeah, he loves
it. Well, out of all the Barbara Streisand, you're going to pick that?
You know what he really loves, too, is when you call it lentil, and you tell him you think it's about soup. He really likes that, too.
All right, I'll keep that in mind.
Yeah. This is a romantic drama film starring Barbara Streisand and Robert Redford, directed by Sidney Pollack. Arthur Lawrence wrote both a novel and a screenplay based on his college days at Cornell University and his experiences with the House Un-American Activities Committee.
Like the communism hunt?
Yeah, the hunt for communism. Yeah.
They commented
on that stuff, yeah. Oh. And they cut a lot of it out. Barbara Streisand was upset by that. But the big thing about this movie is it was James Woods' first film.
He's an ass.
Man, James Woods is not racist or sexist at all.
James Woods is human garbage. Yeah. But this was not... This was not the first one to be released, though.
Isn't it amazing that he has a career with all those kind of opinions out there in Hollywood? You would think that people would...
Well, especially that he's not a very good actor. Like,
right.
He kind of sucks.
I mean, I'm surprised he's had a career that he's had, being that kind of personality.
Well, it's his looks.
Oh, my God. It can't be that.
He's great on The Simpsons.
And did you know Muppet Tuesday, November 20th? This isn't a movie, but on Tuesday, November 20th, 1973, a Charlie Brown Thanksgiving aired for the first time on CBS.
Really?
And it won an Emmy the following year.
That one was newer than the others, I think, right? I think the Charlie Brown Christmas one and the Halloween one were from the 60s, I want to say.
Really, you think?
I think so. And I think that if you look at them side by side, the Thanksgiving one does look newer. Like it almost sounds like the voices might be different people, too.
All right. Saturday, December 8th, 1973. This movie is on the list not for being one of the top grossing, not for winning an Oscar, but because this movie is the first movie to use digital image processing in 1973. Okay. Any idea what that is, Mups?
Westworld.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
You are correct.
I've never heard of that movie.
This is why we have him on here. So. Not only did I not even know this movie ever existed, but this is the idea of the HBO's The Westworld.
Oh, this is the movie that it was based on?
Yeah, that was copied off of this movie.
That was a weird show. We only watched two episodes, I think.
It was getting weird, but...
it was bizarre.
What do you got to say about this movie, Mups?
It's not bad for like a 70s B-movie. It's kind of fun. If you saw the first episode of the HBO show, then that's sort of just what the original movie is. It's just... Two guys go there and cavort around with robots, and then Yul Brynner starts killing everybody.
Oh, wow.
Well, did you know that Arnold Schwarzenegger used Yul Brynner's performance as the basis of his performance in The Terminator?
Oh, really?
I feel like I read that somewhere, but I'm going to pretend I don't know it. Wow, that's interesting.
It was on, it was on IMDb. Well, that was Westworld, which I kind of want to see that just because I didn't know that even existed.
Yeah, it's like a good Sunday afternoon movie. Like, you're just kind of napping on the couch.
Okay. That's where a lot of these movies are.
Well, director John Carpenter also based the indestructible nature of his killer, Michael Myers, in Halloween on Yul Brynner's character in this film.
Oh,
and that ties into the fact that the new Halloween movie just came out.
Yeah, just
came out.
Oh,
did they just do a new one?
Yeah, they redo it? What's the deal with the new movie?
No, the new one, it picks up like 40-50 years after the first one, and ignores all the sequels, and just is a sequel directly to the first Halloween.
Oh, really?
So 50 years later, we're expected to believe that this guy is still this unstoppable killing machine?
I mean, Jamie Lee Curtis is in it, so.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd buy it.
Is she eating Activia in it?
Probably.
Activia. Okay. The next movie was on Sunday, December 16th, 1973. It was released. This is the fourth highest grossing movie of 1973. Do you want to guess?
The Sting?
Nope. This one starts with a P.
With a P.
Directed by Franklin Schaffner.
Oh, Patton.
Nope.
Oh, no.
That was a few years earlier. I think we covered that already. This is a...
Oh, you did cover that. I don't listen to your podcast.
Hey, you asshole.
Hey.
This is a historical period drama prison film.
Oh, Papillon.
Yes.
Papillon.
That's right. I've seen this. Is it about Escape from Alcatraz?
Well, there's a new movie. There's a newer version.
Well, I've seen the Steve McQueen.
Yeah, they remade it.
This is the Steve McQueen.
I've seen the Steve McQueen version, but isn't it about escaping from Alcatraz?
Well, it's escaping from Devil's Island in South America.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, so it's a prison escape movie.
Okay.
It was based on the 1969 autobiography by the French convict Henri Charrière. Anyway, it stars Steve McQueen plays the title character and Dustin Hoffman as Louis Degas. Anyway, the film's title is French for butterfly, referring to Charrière's tattoo of a butterfly and his nickname. Do you have anything to say about this movie? Mups?
No, that's another one I haven't seen, actually.
What? I saw a movie you haven't seen? I think that's a first ever, probably.
Are you sure you saw this?
Yes, I did. Oh, okay. I did see it. It was like Muppet was saying, it was a Sunday on TV.
I'm just saying, when I was little. It's crazy that we found two movies that Muppet doesn't know, because he's the... I was just pumping you up as the guy who's seen every single movie and has owned every single movie. You got some homework to do, mister.
That's right.
Well, you know, I hate 1973.
We had you on the one year you hate.
The one year you hate. Well, while shooting in Jamaica, Dustin Hoffman met Sir Paul McCartney, who was vacationing in Montego Bay. And one evening, Hoffman invited McCartney to dinner and challenged him to write a song about anything. Mm-hmm. And since painter Pablo Picasso had just died, Hoffman requested that McCartney compose a song about Picasso's dying words. Drink to me, drink to my health, you know I can't drink anymore. McCartney created a demo on the spot, and the song Picasso's Last Words, Drink to Me, appeared on Wings' 1973 album, Band on the Run. Too bad Wings sucked.
Yeah. Yeah, Wings is kind of the worst.
It is. Yeah.
They are the worst. Here's some other things. Dustin Hoffman became angry and uncooperative for some time on set after he discovered that although he and Steve McQueen would receive equal billing, he was actually making $750,000 less than his co-star.
Boom.
Oh, burn.
Yeah. And although many consider this Steve McQueen's best performance to date, he was overlooked by the Academy. Some say that was because McQueen had stolen Ally McGraw, who became his second wife, from her husband Robert Evans, who was a powerful studio executive at the time.
Boom.
McQueen was also rumored to have slept with many other Hollywood wives.
Yeah, I think he was crawling with VD.
Yeah.
Pretty sure.
Yeah, you could bottle the VD off of that guy.
Yep.
And sell it. Bottles of VD for sale. It's 1973.
Pretty much.
I'd like a bottle of VD and some Jolt Cola. Okay, on to the next movie. Tuesday, December 25th. That's Christmas Day of 1973. Now we're at the number one movie of the year of 1973. The number one highest grossing.
Okay.
You want to guess that, Mups?
God, if it's Christmas Day, I really want it to be The Exorcist.
I love that.
That didn't come out till the day after Christmas, you idiot. This is The Sting, which you guessed before. It is, yeah, The Sting. What do you got to tell us about The Sting?
It's the second and last pairing of Paul Newman and Robert Redford.
I love them, Sting. I think it's a great movie.
Yeah, it's good. I like it.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen it. It does look good. I will say, out of all these 70s trailers we've watched, I really wanted to see this. So this is a 1973 American caper film set in 1936, involving a complicated plot by two professional grifters, as Mupp said, Paul Newman and Robert Redford, to con a mob boss, Robert Shaw. During filming, Robert Redford was recovering from a broken right thumb sustained in a skiing accident a few months before, and he was supposed to be wearing a cast. Numerous times in the film, he uses his right hand oddly to avoid using the thumb, such as holding a fork with four fingers but not the thumb.
Oh.
So now you got some work for. Yeah.
Holding the fork with four fingers but not the thumb.
But not his thumb. His thumb must be out like this. So if you notice that, that's why.
Oh, he's gripping it like in his fist?
I guess. Here you go. Robert Redford, he didn't see this movie until June
2004.
What?
And And he was forced at gunpoint to watch it.
No, he was not. You're making shit up.
That part I'm making up. But yeah, so he didn't see it.
Why wouldn't you go see your movie?
Because he's Robert fucking Redford. He'd do whatever he wants.
Well, he was.
Yeah, it won like Best Picture that year. Why did he just like, nah, yeah. I don't know.
He was king shit good. In the 70s, though.
He probably didn't give a shit. He probably was busy banging.
King shit of diamond something.
He was banging chicks.
Mountain.
How many chicks do you think he banged?
I don't know.
Do you think he banged any dudes?
Maybe.
You think he helped Paul
He's
Newman?
He's a good-looking man back then.
Yeah, all ladies still talk about how.
And Paul Newman was a good-looking man back
then. They're both good-looking dudes. The movie was filmed on the back lot of Universal Studios, and the diner in which Hooker meets Lonergan is the same diner interior used
computer just
in Back to the Future, in which Marty McFly first meets his father and calls Doc Brown.
Oh, that's interesting.
That diner's in another movie, too, and I can't remember now.
Oh, come on. Come through for us, Mups.
It might be this dumbass movie called City Heat with Burt Reynolds and Clint Eastwood.
Oh, that sounds terrible.
I didn't know those two were in a movie together.
Yeah, it's like the only time they were in a movie together, and everyone was like, oh, great. Good job, guys.
It was a shitty
movie. Isn't Clint Eastwood supposed to be a big prick, too?
Yeah, he seems like it.
Well, and the last thing about The Sting is many characters are seen drinking Schlitz beer during the film.
Yes. Okay.
Schlitz was the largest beer company in the world during the 1930s.
Oh, was it really?
Yep. And now Schlitz is just a joke.
Yep, it is. Is it even out anymore? They don't have Schlitz anymore, do they?
Yeah, they do. They brought back the original formula because Schlitz tasted like garbage.
They brought the original formula because it was so good to begin with.
Yeah.
It tastes like garbage. Well, I remember seeing Schlitz Dark, and I couldn't believe that existed. Oh,
Schlitz Dark. What'd they do? Just pour some Coke syrup in it or something?
I don't know. They make a Schlitz Dark. And I had Schlitz flights for my darts once. But, yeah, I love that. You see, the other thing Mups knows all about
Schlitz
is beer.
Flight.
So I'm glad I brought up Schlitz. Flights for my darts. You know, you put flights
on
darts.
Oh, those things. I thought you were talking about, like, a flight of beers, and you got Schlitz.
I would not get Schlitz.
A flight of Schlitz beers.
Yeah. Unless I wanted to compare diarrhea to something.
Yeah.
Schlitz diarrhea beer. Okay, now.
I have one more thing about the Sting.
Yeah, what?
They shot exteriors in Chicago. And there's one chase scene where I think it's Robert Redford is running on one of the Green Line platforms.
Really?
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool. How often do you take the Green Line there in Chicago?
Sorry, what?
How often do you take the Green Line?
Never.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't remember ever. I don't think I ever set foot on a Green Line. Wait, is that the one that goes out to O'Hare?
No, that's a Blue Line. All right, so now the movie that came out on Wednesday, December 26th, 1973. The Exorcist.
No, wait, that's
Halloween.
That's Halloween.
The Exorcist is...
You fool.
Wait a minute, stop. What's The Exorcist, Muppet?
It's going to sound weird doing it over the phone, but... Like,
that's right.
That sounds like Super Password to me.
It's scarier when...
Yeah, that sounds like a game show.
No, it doesn't when it's real.
All right. What do you guys... Well, I'll just let you guys talk about this because Amy's a big horror film lover.
Well, this is really a scary fucking movie. Like,
yeah.
I don't even think... It's weird because... I don't believe in the devil, but it stands up. There's something about it that is so, like, punchy in the gut. And it...
Yeah, it just... Oh, sorry, go on.
No. I was going to ask you what you think because it's, like, so creepy and scary. And even though, like, I don't know, it doesn't... Even though some of the special effects might look kind of cheesy now, it doesn't take away from it at all.
Yeah, like it's really good at building up this just feeling of dread, even in like the first half where nothing scary is happening. It's just weird shots of like the nuns walking down the street with their habits flowing.
Oh yeah, well, and even like, everything and it just builds so gradually, like with the lights flickering, and then there's the sounds in the attic, and then like she pees on the carpet that one time, and just like it goes so gradually. The tension, it's like somebody's stringing a fiddle with a tension. I don't know what that means, but I was trying to think of a metaphor, but I guess I can't.
I know I didn't see this movie until they re-released it in the theaters when we were all adults
in Chicago, and we went to the Biograph.
You made me see it, but that was the first time. From what, correct me if I'm wrong, both of you, but that was the first time they actually included that scene where she walks
down the stairs, yeah,
back,
yeah,
or like a spider or whatever.
Yeah,
that wasn't in the original,
right?
And I didn't like it, but I don't like this kind of stuff.
But you hate horror movies.
I hate horror movies because I don't understand why you would pay to just feel on edge. Like, it's just gross. I want to take a shower, get away from it, and forget it ever happened.
Jeez, ringing endorsement.
But but I love this. This is a great movie. I want to take a shower and forget it ever happened.
There's a lot of crazy shit that happened with this.
I got a couple of the bullet points that I thought
I could have had this for my story.
Were interesting, but the original teaser trailer, which consisted of nothing but images of the white-faced demon quickly flashing in and out of darkness, was banned in many theaters as it was deemed too frightening.
Yep.
So I think that was cool. Upon its initial theatrical release, the film affected many audiences so strongly that at many theaters, paramedics were called to treat people who fainted and others who went into hysterics.
Is it true?
Yes. Listen to this. Listen to the rest of this. A filmgoer who saw the movie in 1974 during its original release fainted and broke his jaw on the seat in front of him.
Jesus Christ!
He then sued Warner Brothers and the filmmakers, claiming that the use of subliminal imagery in the film had caused him to pass out.
So wait a minute.
And the studio settled.
How do you
court.
Break your jaw? You're sitting down, and you faint in a seat, and you rocket forward into the other seat and break your jaw. Is that what happened?
He must have been leaning forward, and he fainted and broke his jaw on the seat in front of him.
How does that work? I don't even believe it.
Well, the studio settled out of court for an undisclosed sum.
Jesus Christ.
Listen to this. During a 1984 reunion of the cast of The Exorcist on Good Morning America, Ellen Burstyn told a story of when she was in Tucson, Arizona, filming Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore.
Yeah.
And The Exorcist was opening in that city while she was there, so she went to see it.
Oh, my God.
She's not like Robert Redford, not going to see her movie.
Yeah.
And she stated that the scene where this is great. This is so great. She stated that the scene where Regan, is her name Reagan?
Reagan
has her audiogram was the part where most people fainted. That's the scene where
she's in the hospital.
And they shoot it into her neck.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, there's so many gruesome medical procedures in that movie.
They said that's where most people fainted when that thing goes into her neck. After that scene, she saw a woman wobbling up the aisle. So Ellen Burstyn followed her. And when the woman finally fainted, Ellen Burstyn was at her aid. She caught her.
Oh, my God.
And loosened her collar, was trying to talk to her to wake her up. And the woman began to come to.
And looked up and saw Ellen Burstyn.
And Ellen Burstyn realized that if this woman opens her eyes and sees her, she might panic even more because she thinks she's in the movie. So Ellen Burstyn, her exact words were that she might think she was in the Twilight Zone or something, so she asked for assistance from another person to help the woman recover, and then she left.
Oh, my God. That's so great. Her own movie.
Also, Ellen Burstyn received a permanent spinal injury during filming.
I knew that.
Yep.
When she was thrown away from her possessed daughter, a harness jerked her away from the bed, and she fell on her coccyx.
Oh, I bruised my coccyx. Pain.
Yeah, your coccyx really can't take a lot of damage. The only other thing I had about this is the bedroom set had to be refrigerated to capture the authentic icy breath of the actors in the exercising scenes.
So it was like real cold in there.
Yeah. And Linda Blair, who was in a film's flimsy nightgown, says to this day she cannot stand being cold.
Oh, I bet. Yeah, I'm
so
surprised.
They refrigerated the whole set.
And she was in that little, and she was a lot of times she was wet because of that
soup
and stuff.
All over,
and
yeah.
God, the poor girl.
Yeah.
All the fake blood and everything.
Yeah.
I guess there was only that one scene where there's lots of blood, but
I don't know. don't know. That movie, I just, yeah.
Well, there was another thing. You don't have the part about where they played it in Italy somewhere and lightning struck a clock tower or a church steeple?
No, I didn't know about this.
There's all kinds of crazy shit like that. Like, they played it, debuted it in Italy, and there was a lightning storm, and lightning struck the cross on a church steeple during the movie.
I didn't hear about that.
And stuff like that. Muppet, have you ever heard any of those stories?
I know there were, like, weird things associated with it, but I don't know that one specifically.
There's, like, a couple people died.
Yeah, there's a lot of murders and things with it, too.
I think the whole set burned down once or twice.
Yeah, and I didn't include it because I thought maybe you were going to cover it. There was a guy who was convicted of murder, right, that worked on it?
Yeah, serial killer is in it. He plays one of the hospital...
Yeah, he's like an extra or something in the background.
He has like a couple lines.
Yeah.
And he turned out to be a serial killer later.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I mean, that's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, why didn't you cover that guy?
Yeah, I think it's interesting that Max von Sydow, who played The Exorcist, is like 35 in that movie.
Oh, my God,
and
he looks so old.
The way they made him up is literally how he looks right now.
Yeah. So they made him up perfectly.
Yeah.
I wondered how that was. Like.
Well, he physicalized that part so well. He was so, he seemed like an old man, like frail and weak. You know, especially after when they start the exorcism.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it really made it look like he was, like, right before he dies.
What else was he in?
He was in Force Awakens in the very beginning.
He was?
Yeah, he's the old man who gives...
Yeah, he's that old man at the beginning.
Yeah.
That's who that man was. I remember seeing Force Awakens, like, who is that guy? So he's the
I think he's been
guy.
In a lot of stuff.
Yeah, he's in a lot of... Ingmar Bergman movies in Sweden. I'm pretty sure you guys saw all those, right?
Name all of them.
Yeah, right.
let's see. Seven Seal, Wild Strawberries.
God.
Okay, let's get to what we really brought Muppet here for, and it's this. The English Patient sucks.
It's this terrible movie.
Hey. I am the only one on the planet who still likes that movie.
It was terrible. I didn't see it.
It was awful.
I tried to watch it several times. I just kept falling into a coma. I kept injuring myself. But that's all the movies
you fell. You fell into the chair in front of you.
Yeah,
broke your jaw.
Yeah, I broke my jaw in the chair in front of me. But that's. I think that's. Yeah, that's all the movies of 1973 that we're going to talk about. So thanks for joining us, movie expert Mups.
No problem.
Thanks, fella.
Do you have anything else to tell our listeners?
Got anything to plug?
No, I'm a loser.
you have any
just movies.
Do you have any? What's your favorite? Like what's your current favorite beer right now?
Probably Spiteful Alley Time.
What kind of beer is that?
The pale ale from Chicago.
Okay.
Sounds like
what
sounds
brewery?
Like a dream.
Spiteful.
Oh, Spiteful. You said that already. Spiteful. What is it? What's the beer name?
Alley Time.
Oh, Alley Time. Spiteful Alley Time. Okay. And where's your favorite bar? Do you want to give a plug for your favorite bar?
Sure. Green Lady in Chicago, Illinois.
Sweet. Right.
Green Lady.
Walking Distance is Muppet's favorite bar.
Yeah.
That's the name of Muppet's favorite
pretty much.
Bar. Walking Distance.
On the north side of Chicago.
I just get a bunch of Schlitz and drink in the alley.
That's right.
Yeah, that's good. Schlitz is delicious. Okay, moving on to... Saturday, August 18th, 1973. Diana Ross,
mm-hmm.
Touch Me in the Morning.
Not familiar with that one.
You're not?
I don't think so.
It was recorded in the early morning hours, as was her custom after she began raising her children. In a Barbara Walters Mother's Day interview special, her second oldest daughter, Tracy Ellis Ross, said Diana would put them to bed and record all night.
Jeez.
In order to be able to get her children up and send them to school on time the next morning. Isn't that crazy? That's why I left there, because that was odd.
It's weird to think of like somebody like Diana Ross
being a parent,
getting
her kids.
Children ready in the morning and stuff. Like that's
because why wouldn't she just have the help
nanny
do it?
You
know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which maybe it was just important to her to make sure she was there for the kids or whatever. I know you've heard this. It's terrible.
Is it?
I mean, it's not my kind of music, so maybe I've realized I need to stop. Saying things are terrible just because they're not
my... Just you don't like them.
Well, some I will. I'll still say it, but it's just not my kind of music. So people that like this music might like it, but...
Touch me in the
Just when I listen to this. Just picture being in the back of a station wagon.
Yeah, I know, right?
With my ruse.
In the way back where the carpet was.
Yep.
With like shag carpeting in the back of the
station
wagon.
With like a winter coat that has rainbow designs on it. And
that's
the zipper's stuck.
There's gum mushed into the carpet on the way back.
And you're wearing a stocking cap with a puffball on top.
That's right.
Yeah, there's
you
no
must not
belts.
Have had heat in your particular station wagon, because I don't remember being that bundled up in the station wagon.
I live in the north. I'm from the north. So that's a stupid, shitty song.
Yeah.
And it sucks. Oh, but that's just not my kind of music. I don't like ballads. I've never liked ballads.
Well, we've been through that in the 80s. It was ballad.
They're so shitty. It was Ballad City in the 80s. August 25th. It's a Saturday, 1973. We got a new number one song on the Billboard charts. A song about an interracial love affair. Brother Louie.
Okay.
You would know this song as the theme song to Louis C.K.'s show.
Louie, I like that song.
Louie, you're gonna die. Louie, you're gonna die.
Of course, now it's kind of creepy.
Louie. Yeah, I know. Now that he masturbated in front of a bunch of people and forced them to watch him masturbate, now this song is ruined.
It's creepy.
But the whole song is great. Like, it really, I didn't realize that was like a song that was already popular in the past, but it was.
Oh, yeah. And you didn't know that?
No.
I'd never heard
that song before.
I remember that song very vividly.
You do?
Mm-hmm.
Did you realize that it was about an interracial love affair?
No.
Well, it is.
I don't think any, but I didn't think about the words like our kids do that all the time where they listen to the words to songs.
They do. And all the words about twerking and banging everybody.
Yeah, and when I was little, they were singing about all kinds of dirty shit, and I never even once questioned it.
Yeah, we never thought
about
it. Like
Olivia Newton-John, who was my idol, singing about Let's Get Physical.
Yeah, she's talking about banging
and
dudes.
I would sit there and sing my heart out to that song and never once considered what she was talking about.
Well, she was also cleverly disguising it by doing the video of working out.
Yeah,
so for kids, it looked like that's all it was, but now the videos aren't clever like that. The videos now are people having butt sex.
Yeah, I know, right?
So it's like you never...
it's a little bit of a problem.
There's no thinly veiling anything.
No.
But anyway, this Brother Louie song, this version was actually redone by a band called an American band called Stories.
Okay.
Featuring singer Ian Lloyd. Yeah. But their version is the one that made number one in the U.S. and sold a bunch of copies. But that's it. Louie. And then Saturday, September 1st, 1973.
Mm-hmm.
This is something you wouldn't have known. You're not going to have known this.
Okay.
Robin Williams and Christopher Reeves went to Juilliard to school together.
Oh, wow.
The Juilliard School.
Yeah.
They were two of 20 students that were accepted in the freshman class in 1973. It started in September.
Oh, wow.
William Hurt and Mandy Patinkin were other classmates in that class.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, that is crazy.
No, who would have known that? And Robin Williams and Christopher Reeve remained close friends until Reeve's death in 2004. Reeve had struggled for years with being quadriplegic after his horse riding accident. Williams' son, Zach, remembered their friendship as having been like brothers from another mother. Robin Williams paid many of Reeves' medical bills and gave financial support to his family.
Wow.
Did you know that?
No.
I didn't know that they even knew each other.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, so here you go. Rest in peace, Robin Williams and Christopher Reeve. Hopefully they're together.
Together again.
Together again forever, sexually. I have to ruin everything by saying stuff like that. Then September 8th, 1973, Marvin Gaye takes over the Billboard number one spot.
Yes. Before he was murdered by his dad.
This is before he was murdered. He was still alive when he recorded this. He was alive and not dead. But this song is responsible for Marvin Gaye.
Healing.
No, this is responsible for him. It's the most successful single for Motown and one of his most well-known songs.
What's going on?
With the help of this song's sexually explicit content, this song helped give Marvin Gaye a reputation as a sex icon during its initial popularity. Let's get it on.
Oh, let's get it on.
Yeah. Bam, bam, bam. You know, the beginning
of
this
is
like the beginning of this. And the best karaoke version of this is Mr. Larry Coplow.
Right.
We have a friend named Larry who's a tiny version of Matthew Broderick mixed with John Stewart, and he does this song great. But the beginning of the song, that it's like instantly it's used in all pop culture media as sex is about
getting
to
ready
happen.
To
like,
sex.
Yeah, as any sexy moment, you just start with that song.
That's right.
But it's great. It's just like, yeah, Sex City.
Yes.
Let's get it on. How's that start? What's the first line he says?
I've been feeling
dry, baby. I've been really trying, baby.
Let's get it on. Let's have sex.
Trying to hold back this feeling.
All right, what's next?
And then on Tuesday, September 18th, 1973, Jimmy Carter, President Jimmy Carter, future president, because he wasn't president yet.
Okay.
Jimmy Carter reported a UFO sighting.
He did?
Yeah. Yep. One evening in 1969, 2 years before this, he became governor of Georgia. Carter was preparing to give a speech at a Lions Club meeting. At about 7:15 Eastern time, one of the guests called his attention to a strange object that was visible about 30 degrees above the horizon to the west of where he was standing. Carter described the object as being bright white and as being about as bright as the moon. It was said to have appeared
That's bright.
It was said to have appeared to have closed in on where he was standing, but to have stopped beyond a stand of pine trees some distance from him. The object is then said to have changed color, first to blue, then to red, then back to white, before appearing to recede into the distance. Carter felt the object was self-illuminated and not solid in nature. His report indicated that it was witnessed by about 10 or 12 other people and was in view for 10 to 12 minutes before it passed out of sight.
Can you imagine experiencing that?
I can't.
That is crazy.
And this is Jimmy Carter. You can't say he's nuts.
I mean, I can't. No, I mean, he must have seen it, but can you just imagine that?
But he didn't report it until 1973. 1973, Carter said, there were about 20 of us standing outside a little restaurant, I believe a high school lunchroom.
That's a terrible Jimmy Carter.
And a kind of green light appeared in the western sky. Habitat for Humanity. This was right after sundown. It got brighter and brighter, and then it eventually disappeared. It didn't have any solid...
He doesn't have a twang. He's got a drawl.
What's the difference? It didn't have any solid...
In a drawl, they don't say the ahs.
Oh. A drawl, they don't say the ahs?
No, not a...
Drawl, I can't say. And it... Anyway, it eventually disappeared. It didn't have any solid substance to it. It was just a very peculiar-looking light. None of us could understand what it was.
Yep, that's crazy.
Thursday, September 20th, 1973, we have an airplane celebrity death.
Okay.
Jim Croce.
Oh, I forgot that he died in an airplane.
Yeah, he did.
I forgot that. There's a lot of celebrities that die in airplanes.
They really
if you think
do.
About
well,
it.
Well, if you think about it, they have to fly all over the place for shows.
Yeah, that's
and stuff,
true.
So I guess that's probably why. But there's always... you know, you tell me if this is one of these that is just creepy because it happened. You know, like, you know how you like you look for clues of things to be creepy when things like this happen?
Right.
Some are just coincidence. But Jim Croce sent a letter to his wife before he died where he talked about giving up his singing career to write short stories and movie scripts.
Oh.
The last words of his letter were, "Remember, it's the first 60 years that count, and I've got 30 to go. I love you, Jim."
Wow. That's kind of weird.
Yeah. I mean, it's not super weird, I guess, but it's kind of weird. Like, whenever you look back on, whenever somebody dies, I guess you look back on things they might have said.
But he was going to give up a singing career. Maybe somebody didn't want him to. But then why would they kill him?
Yeah.
I guess that doesn't make sense.
No. No, it's just fate, I think.
That's weird that he said that he had 30 more years to go.
Croce and five others died when their chartered Beechcraft E-18S crashed into a tree during takeoff from the Natchitoches Regional Airport in Natchitoches, Louisiana.
Okay.
And an hour before, Croce had played a concert at Northwestern State University's Prather Coliseum in Natchitoches. He was flying to Sherman, Texas for a concert at Austin College. Croce was 30 years old.
Wow, he was young.
An investigation showed the plane crashed after clipping a pecan tree at the end of the runway. The pilot had failed. You know, a pecan tree, they shouldn't have put it at the end of the runway.
At the end of the runway, no.
Really, like, Now, where should I put this pecan tree? Oh, maybe at the end of the runway, the airport runway?
Yeah, that's probably not a good idea.
The pilot had failed to gain sufficient altitude to clear the tree and not try to avoid it, even though it was the only tree in the area. It was dark, but there was a clear sky, calm winds, and over 5 miles of visibility with haze.
Hmm.
The report from the NTSB named the probable cause as the pilot's failure to see the obstruction because of his physical impairment.
Oh, was
and
he
the fog
drunk?
Reducing his vision. The 57-year-old Elliot suffered from severe coronary artery disease and had run 3 miles to the airport from a motel.
Oh. So he had a heart attack?
I guess he was having a heart attack or something.
Hmm.
Yeah, that sucks.
That's interesting.
Poor Jim Croce.
Yep.
If that guy had just eaten Cheerios more often and gotten regular exercise.
Maybe things would have been different.
Yeah, Jim Croce's dead.
Because some guy like,
died.
Yeah.
I know you're a big Croce fan.
I like his stuff.
Do you?
That's not bad.
It's soft and sweet.
Yeah.
Kind of nice. And yeah, there's nothing wrong with it.
Just like you, babe.
That's the nicest thing anybody's ever said to me.
I take it back.
Well, you take it back. So, and then Saturday, September 22nd, 1973, another fucking Helen Reddy song.
I am woman, hear me roar.
No, we did that one already. Helen Reddy sucked. Delta Dawn.
Oh, God, how does that go?
Oh,
it's on the tip of my tongue.
Oh, it's so shitty.
Now you got to play it.
Oh, man, it's so awful.
Delta Dawn. No, that's Country Road.
Delta Dawn, hear me roar.
None of that's not right.
So awful.
I swear to God we sang this in music class. In public school music class.
It sounds terrible. It's like
do you remember those when we were in elementary school, those textbooks that had music in them and you'd use them in music class and it was an actual textbook, and this I swear to God was in there.
It probably was. I know we sang Leaving on a
Just
dip.
Like that.
Yeah. We used to play Grandma's Feather Bed. Remember that one?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
We didn't get much sleep, but we had a lot of fun.
Grandma's Feather Bed.
Yeah, we used to sing that all the time. We had a cool young teacher, music teacher, that came in elementary school. But anyway, Delta Dawn, I didn't even do any research on that song because I just hate it. Sorry, everyone. Sorry, Delta Dawn fans. I don't like country music much. And maybe that's a little bit folk, a little bit country, but it's not good.
Yeah.
Luckily, on September 29th, 1973, Grand Funk knocked Helen Reddy the fuck off the charts.
Oh.
With a great song.
Yeah.
You know what song? Grand Funk. Do you know who Grand Funk is?
Yeah. Is it Grand Funk Railroad?
They were just Grand Funk in 1973.
Oh. Was it... we're an American band.
Yes.
Oh,
can you see
sweet.
That from here?
Is we're an American band.
And this song, man, I got to say, this song still rocks.
Town.
Like, if you play it.
Party down. We're in American
band. It's really good. It was sung by the drummer Don Brewer, who began doing more lead vocals for the band and helped with their transition to making top 40 hits. His lyrics are somewhat autobiographical, detailing the band's recent tour and their energetic live performances. In the song, he mentions playing poker with blues great Freddie King, traveling through Little Rock, Arkansas, as well as stopping to party with four groupies who snuck into their hotel in Omaha, Nebraska. The lyrics also mention Sweet Sweet Connie in reference to the legendary groupie Connie. I forgot her last name. I had it written down.
Somewhere. Oh, that's
there was
good.
A legendary groupie named Connie.
She's legendary. Yeah. So legendary, she only went by her first name like Madonna.
And... Yeah, she slept with Neil Diamond, Paul Schaefer, Jimmy Page, John
Bonham, God.
David Lee Roth, Alice Cooper, and Keith Moon.
And they put her in their song?
She claimed to have had sex with numerous rock musicians. Oh, Connie Hamsey. She also received some attention for her claim that she was propositioned by Bill Clinton, then governor of Arkansas. Like, she was one of the first people that came out and said Bill Clinton was trying to bang her.
And what was her name? Connie?
Connie Hamsey.
It sounds like Bonnie Lee Blakely.
And then she ran for House of Rep. She ran for a Senate or something, or Congress.
Jeez. And what was her platform? I will have sex with everybody in town.
She said in 1984 she had been approached by an Arkansas state trooper on behalf of Bill Clinton.
Okay.
George Stephanopoulos later recounted that Clinton told him a different story of this meeting with Hamzy. According to Clinton, Hamzy had approached him in a hotel lobby, flipped down her bikini top, and asked him, "What do you think of these?"
Jeez.
Stephanopoulos secured affidavits from three people who had been accompanying Clinton and confirmed Clinton's recollection. When asked about Hamzy by reporters, Stephanopoulos responded by denying the story off the record and offering to provide the affidavits also off the record.
Okay.
So, yeah, so that's how she was, she was with Bill Clinton. That's the Bill Clinton part.
Okay.
Connie Hamzy. And then on October 6th, 1973, Cher takes over the Billboard charts. And this had a little bit of controversy. You know what song?
Well, it's a controversial one?
Much later. Not in 1973, it wasn't controversial, but...
It was probably Half-Breed.
Somewhat recent. Half-Breed, yeah. You remember? You knew that song?
I don't know if I remember it from then, but since then, I have heard about it and know of it and stuff. You know what I mean? Like, I don't remember listening to it as a kid.
It's a shitty song, too. Of course, I'm not a Cher fan, but if you look at, there's a video on YouTube, and the video is from the Cher and Sonny show.
Oh, it is?
Happy Hour.
She sing Half Breed during that?
Yeah, and she's sitting on a horse. Yeah, so she's dressed up as a Native American stereotype.
Yeah.
And so she's just sitting there on a horse the whole time. Like, it's just weird. Most boring. But it got a lot of controversy later on Twitter, and Cher got in a big argument in a Twitter war with somebody who was saying that she was racist, and she's like, "No, I'm not. I'm not racist. I love Native American people." And
so she's not Native American.
No, she's not.
When I was little, I remember thinking she was.
Yeah, you would.
But even
that's kind of why
the Cher Barbie doll that came out. She had a Native American outfit.
Yeah, probably because of that song.
Yeah.
And she didn't, I think at the time, she didn't dispel rumors that she was, but she was Armenian. Her family's Armenian, I think is what it was. Wednesday, October 10th, 1973.
Yeah.
Spiro T. Agnew resigned as U.S. vice president, and then in federal court in Baltimore pled no contest to income tax evasion.
Boom.
He was fined $10,000 and put on 3 years probation.
1973 would come to be known as a major year in UFO sighting history.
Oh, because of Jimmy Carter?
Because of Jimmy Carter. Each time there is an increase in UFO activity, it's called a flap.
Really?
And 1973 is one of the most active flaps ever to be investigated.
You know, I'd like to investigate your active flaps.
All right. Never before had so many encounters been reported. Shut up.
Sorry.
A recap of 1973 reads like a slow but progressive invasion of planet Earth. The first date is January 2nd, 1973.
Oh, that happens to be... I can't believe that's the first date because that actually is the day that a TV movie was on starring Alex Karras as the 500-pound jerk. An advertising man's dream of turning a huge hillbilly into a weightlifting champion is blocked when the hillbilly falls for a Russian gymnast.
Oh, that sounds awful.
That was on TV, so that would make sense that aliens would come down. Like, the hell are you watching?
On that date in Santa Ana, California, at least 8 people reported seeing a large dome-shaped object hovering above the town. Witnesses reported that at times the craft hovered as low as 200 feet from the ground. The witnesses described the object as metallic gray in color. After hovering for several seconds, the object sped toward the southwest at terrific speed. January and February 1973, in Cherokee County, South Carolina, the police department received so many UFO reports that they stopped sending cars out to investigate. The sightings reported to police were in the hundreds. The objects described were cylindrical, cigar-shaped, square, or round with a dome on the top.
I guess what... Why would the police respond? Like, what are they going to do?
I know,
like, what,
right?
Seriously, there's an alien shit. What am I going to do as a police officer? Yes. I don't have...
You don't have the proper laser guns.
I don't have a police helicopter. If I do, like, what am I going to do? Like, go up?
Yeah.
I don't know. What are you going to... What can you do? They're aliens.
During February in Wood River Junction, Rhode Island, week after week, residents reported seeing a huge bright white light moving slowly above the community. More than 250 people reported seeing the object. The object was said to be almost half the size of a house and hovered soundlessly over the treetops. That's a lot of the reports that they say they don't make any sound at all.
And they're big as a house. That's like that one we talked about in a previous episode that was just the size of a house and it was quiet, not making a sound.
And it's like, and like that's part of what would make it so eerie. I think. If you saw something, especially if it was only 200 feet off the ground.
Almost more
and,
eerie.
And it was completely silent.
Yeah, if it was going like,
yeah,
that
right.
would be at least
something.
Know,
but if it's
sense.
Like completely silent, and, but it's just this, how eerie is that,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, like, do I really see this? Is mm-hmm. this really happening?
That's right. Then on March 1st, 1973,
yeah.
in Sailors Lake, Pennsylvania, there were 42 objects with flashing lights observed by witnesses during a three-hour period.
42?
Yes. A dozen witnesses, including a state trooper, saw the objects moving over the lake.
Did that state trooper have a mustache?
I bet he did.
Yeah, he probably
did. I bet you did. April 6th.
Oh, April 6th, 1973. Oh, when the Brian Keith show was on?
Yep.
Brian Keith starred in this show in his first season, Father and Daughter Pediatricians.
Who the hell is Brian Keith, and why do we care?
Some heavy guy that had his own show. Dr. Sean Jameson and Dr. Ann Jameson run a free clinic in Oahu, Hawaii.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
All
what
right.
it's about.
In that date, in Elsinore, Missouri, a domed disc-shaped object with portals and a landing gear lands in the woods about 3 miles west of the city.
What?
Three holes in the ground arranged in a triangular pattern were found at the site, along with some damaged foliage.
Foliage?
Foliage.
Are you familiar with that city?
No. I don't know where that
You're
is.
You're from Missouri.
I know, but I don't know where Elsinore is.
You got to represent.
April 10th.
Oh, my gosh. These keep happening. April 10th?
Yep.
Now, you can't tell me there was an alien the same time that... The same day that Carol Burnett, Betty White, and Rod Serling were all on Password All-Stars, can you?
Oh, my God. That's a battle of the network stars right there.
It is right there.
In April 10th in Stockard County, Missouri, sheriffs and others reported three objects over Bernie and Dexter. The objects changed color from red to white to blue.
Wait.
Starting and stopping in the sky.
So that's what George, that's
what Jimmy Carter said.
Jimmy Carter said the same thing.
That's what you told me. I couldn't believe it.
So I was blowing your mind when I
you
said
did,
that because you already done
but
this
I didn't
research.
Want to give it away.
Say that story again over Bernie and Dexter. What's Bernie and Dexter?
Those are towns in Stockard County,
those
Missouri.
Those are two towns.
Yeah.
I was like, who's Bernie?
Who's Bernie and Dexter? I guess that's true. The objects changed in color from red to white to blue, starting and stopping in the sky.
Holy shit.
Isn't that crazy?
Jimmy Carter ain't fucking around.
And then on May 12th.
On May 12th, the day that Mackenzie Astin was born.
Oh my
Patty
God.
Duke and John Astin was probably holding her hand. Patty Duke and John Astin had a baby.
Oh, okay.
And that baby would later be on Facts of Life. She was giving birth as an alien?
Who'd she play on Facts of Life?
No, Mackenzie Astin was on Facts of Life.
As who?
The little boy. Remember when they added? You know how sitcoms?
Jesus, no.
When sitcoms
I don't
got
watch
crappy,
them when they do that.
They add a kid.
I don't want to know.
He was like the boy that they added with George Clooney.
Why would
Clooney.
They add a boy?
They had
That's so dumb.
A cute boy to get ratings.
It's the stupidest thing
and
ever.
And then George Clooney was on.
So on that day, on May 12th, near Kent, Ohio, a witness was driving west near Kent and saw a group of flashing lights above his car. He stopped and the object stopped. He described a football-shaped object that changed colors in a pattern from red to white to blue.
Holy shit.
Yep. He saw a figure materialize, humanoid in shape, approximately 10 feet below the object. The figure rapidly descended and seemed to look at the witness. After about 30 seconds, the figure then ascended. The figure was silver in color, lacking hair, eyes, and ears.
Not even eyes? But just a nose?
I guess.
Not a mouth?
Yeah, I guess. On June 2nd.
Oh, God. More stuff?
Yeah.
June 2nd, 1973. It was a Saturday. And Larry Hagman and Diane Baker were starring on a show called Here We Go Again. This show, the comedic problems ensue when a newlywed couple moves into a home located very close to the homes of their former spouses.
Oh.
Remember that show, Here We Go Again?
Nope.
Larry Hagman and Diane Baker, y'all.
On June 2nd in DeVernon, Illinois.
DeVernon.
A UFO with bright running lights was seen. A large orange light was turned on directly below the UFO, lighting the landscape. A witness was awakened when the dog barked. The craft was described as football-shaped and about the size of a car.
Huh.
From August to October, there was a flurry of sightings witnessed by police and citizens. One of the most famous cases was the Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker abduction. Charles Hickson, the chief claimant in the Pascagoula, Mississippi UFO abduction case.
Pascagoula.
This is the story of this.
When did that happen?
He died of a heart attack on September 9th, 2011 at the age of 80. Until his death, he maintained the truth of his alien encounter. part of the UFO flap of 1973.
Flap.
It has remained, after the Benny and Barney Hill case of 1961, the second most famous UFO abduction case in history, according to UFO historians.
Really? Even more famous than the Fire in the Sky one?
That's what they say.
Huh.
October 11th, 1973.
Oh, the same day Kung Fu was on with David Carradine.
I used to watch that.
You did?
Yeah, I know. It was.
You watched Kung Fu with David Carradine?
It was on one of the five channels. It was on Relate at Night.
Well, on this episode, Kane promised a dying priest who stole a golden chalice that he will recover it from three murdering bandits so his soul will be saved.
Okay. So this is, sorry.
This is Charles
Hickson's account of the abduction.
On October 11th.
Quote, Calvin was working for me at Walker's Shipyard and doing a dadgum good job.
Dadgummit.
Calvin and his brother had sort of grown up with my oldest boy, Eddie. Some evenings after work, we'd go fishing. We got off at about 4 o'clock that day and came by my house to get the fishing tackle.
Do they do any kissing while they're fishing, like
they
on
might.
Ozark?
Then we went and got some shrimp for bait. We tried several places and hadn't caught anything. Calvin, there's one more place I want to try. If they don't bite there, we'll give up and go on home.
Okay. I was going to say, it'd be difficult to use shrimp for bait without wanting to eat that delicious shrimp.
Yeah. So we went down toward Ingalls and started fishing off a pier. We sat there for a little while, and I finally got a bite. I was reeling in and started hearing this hissing sound, like steam coming out of a pipe. I looked around, and it just startled me. Something was hovering 2 or 3 feet. Stop it.
I was adding.
Something was hovering 2 or 3 feet above the ground, probably no more than 10 or 15 yards from us. There were two blue flashing lights on the top part of the end that was toward us. I couldn't tell if it was round or oblong. I could see a little dome on top, but I couldn't see all the way around the thing, so I couldn't tell for sure how big it was. I jumped to my feet, looked over at Calvin, and he looked plumb strange. Then a door opened and this brilliant light came out of it. I couldn't figure what was in the world was happening. I'd known fear. I fought 20 months in hand-to-hand combat in Korea. The only thing I'm scared of is a snake. I'll run from a snake, but this wasn't normal. All of a sudden, these three things began coming out of the door. They looked like they had elephant skin, wrinkled, real wrinkled, and triangle-shaped ears that had to be some sort of antennas.
Huh.
These things were robots. They seemed to come right out of the beam of light. They never touched the ground. They moved right out there beside me and Calvin. I couldn't move, and neither could he. Two of them came around behind me, took me under each arm. When they grabbed me, I seemed to rise it to their height. They weren't as tall as me, but they sort of had me in a leaning position. One took hold of Calvin, and I saw him go limp. He told me later he had fainted. They took us through the doorway in the middle of a room, and I couldn't see Calvin anymore. There was nothing in there, just a real bright glow. I couldn't move anything but my eyes. They let go of me. I still wasn't touching nothing, just kind of floating. All I could think was, what are they going to do with us?
Anal probe.
They'd take us off and we'd never see our families again.
And an anal probe.
I didn't see the robots for a while. Then an eyeball about the size of a football came out of the wall. It moved right in front of my face. I saw dials and gadgets moving around. It went behind me, then came back over me. Then it disappeared back into the wall.
What? That's messed up. Where's the anal probe start?
I was just about out of my mind. I thought they were going to kill me. Folks would think we fell off in the river and drowned, and nobody would ever know about this. It seemed like a long time, but it couldn't have been more than a few minutes. The robots came and carried me back outside. They didn't throw me down. They eased me down. And when they did, I fell to the ground. My legs were real weak. I saw Calvin standing there staring out at the water. He was in shock. I've seen men in shock, and if you don't do something pretty quick, they'll die. I started going over to where he was, and I saw the craft leave. The blue lights were on again. I remember that.
Like maybe an anal probe will help him.
When I got to Calvin, I had to slap him a time or two. I finally got to him where he could say something. Problem. He said, Charlie, what in the world was that? I said, son, I don't know, but they didn't kill us. Although the UFO reported by the men had apparently not been seen. So this is the story again.
Okay.
Had apparently not been seen by people on the heavily traveled nearby highway. There had been other UFO sightings in the area, including on the night in question. Several people later reported strange lights in the Gulf Coast sky just after sunset on October 11th, about the time Hickson and then 19-year-old Calvin Parker said they were abducted.
All right, I believe in this now.
Mike Cantaldo, a retired Navy Chief Petty Officer now living in who cares where he lives?
Mike can tell,
says
though.
He saw a very strange object on the horizon late that afternoon.
Well, our listeners might want to track him down, so we should say where he lives.
Puddin' Brodus, a Pascagoula detective back then.
Wait a second. You can't just brush over that. There's a Pascagoula detective named Puddin'?
Yep.
Puddin' Brodus?
Puddin'. Yep.
Brodus is Puddin' last?
Brodus.
You know, Calvin Brodus is Snoop Dogg.
Oh, yes.
So maybe
they're related.
Maybe he's got a cousin named
He
Puddin'.
Told me he saw something streak through the air, said Glenn Ryder, a former captain with Jackson County Sheriff's Department, who was the first to interrogate Hickson and Parker.
Puddin'.
Puddin's dead now, but he was a fine man. He wouldn't make up something like that. A guard at the shipbuilding place saw it. Another guy was in his backyard, and he saw something streak above his house. When we studied all those reports, we're in a straight line. And I'll tell you this. After talking with Hickson and Parker that night, I'm convinced they had some kind of experience. I don't know exactly what, but something happened to them. They were both shook up, especially that boy.
Holy
shit. As they drove away in Parker's Plymouth, Hickson and Parker agreed not to tell anyone about the incident. I know people would call us crazy and everything else, Hickson says. But I thought about it some more and said, what if it's a threat to our country? That's when I decided to call the Air Force Base in Biloxi.
Just to let them know. But and the crazy thing is they must not have started the anal probes until later.
Yeah,
in the
not
80s.
Yet. The person who answered the phone at the Air Force Base said they didn't investigate UFOs and suggested Hickson call the Sheriff's Department. That's when Hickson spoke with Glenn Ryder from a convenience store payphone. He said, I want to tell you something, but you've got to promise not to laugh, recalls Ryder, now 63 and retired. I was about to get off work, so it's kind of aggravated me. And I said, if you want to tell me something, then tell me. He asked me again to promise not to laugh, so I promised. He said, I just got picked up by a UFO. And, of course, I burst out laughing. He got real upset, so I apologized and told him to go ahead with his story. I could tell he was serious. Ryder convinced Hickson and Parker to drive to the sheriff's office. He called Jackson County Sheriff Fred Diamond, now deceased, to join him for questioning. So they get in there, and they go in for questioning. And
did he smell like rum?
No, but he says, Charlie says, right when they walked in, Charlie said, I just want to tell you up front, I've had a drink. I had something to try to settle my nerves.
Yeah, you know.
The young boy was real fidgety. He was about to crawl the walls. Hickson and Parker told the officers what had happened. Ryder says it was a struggle to keep a straight face. Then he and Diamond plotted to find out the truth. We kept a tape recorder on the top drawer of the desk, Ryder says. It was a small office, so it would pick up everything said in there. We let them go to the bathroom and decided to turn the recorder on, then leave them alone for a while. We did that, and when we listened to the tape later, we expected to hear them saying, boy, we sure fooled them or something like that. But they didn't. And you can hear this recording on the online.
Yeah, you can.
Of the two of them talking after they leave, and they're very, very freaked out.
What do you Google to find that?
I guess it would be Hickson. I keep forgetting their full names. Charles Hickson and Calvin Parker.
Puddin'?
Abduction.
Don't Google Puddin'.
Or Pascagoula UFO incident. Is
Pascagoula
another.
UFO incident recording, maybe, and you want to listen to that.
Yeah.
Because I definitely want to listen to that. And that's what convinces me kind of more than anything, is that they recorded them while they didn't think they were being recorded, and they didn't say anything. But, you know, the famous Simpsons episode where the alien is there and he abducts somebody. And then they just spray rum all over him.
Yeah.
The aliens spray rum all over him afterwards so nobody will believe him.
Yeah. So they ended up getting, like, interrogated at the Air Force Base. They got medical examinations to
make. Now they got the anal probes.
And, yeah, probably. And everybody that interviewed him believed him.
As long as there's anal probes in there somewhere, then I'll believe it.
Hickson even went to undergo hypnosis because, of course, you did back then.
Yeah.
And his story was basically the same during each session. He said, under deep hypnosis once, I discovered something that still gives me chills. There were people on that spaceship, living beings in another compartment. They never came in there where we were. And I'm telling you, they looked almost like us.
Really?
Only thing I can figure is that they couldn't live in our atmosphere, so they let the robots come out there and carry us inside. And then he said, on Mother's Day, May 1974, Hickson was riding back from a family get-together in Jones County with his wife, their son and daughter, and the man the daughter was married to at the time. It was almost midnight, Hickson says, and I kept noticing a light back behind us. I nudged Sheila, who was sitting on the front seat beside me, and said,
fucking
look out
Sheila.
The window and see if that light ain't following
Sheila,
us.
Sheila, look out that window, Sheila.
She looked out the window and just froze. Blanche saw it and started screaming. Seconds later, a saucer-shaped craft was hovering 150 feet above and to the right of their car. I saw it with my own eyes, said Sheila, who was 18 at the time. Mama was so scared she was screaming. It was a terrifying thing to see, Blanche Hickson says. It affected me bad, tore me up. We stopped the car, and Charles wanted to get out, but I wouldn't let him. We were all grabbing him and holding him. It hovered there a while, then just disappeared. Charles Hickson, who's 1983, he did a book, says that wasn't the first sighting he's had since the initial encounter. While squirrel hunting in February 1974, again, he knelt down beside a tree to eat a sandwich. Through the brush, he says,
was it
part
a squirrel
of a crack
sandwich?
Was visible. Suddenly, he heard a voice. It was like a radio signal or something inside my head, he says. They said, tell people we mean you no harm. You have endured. You have been chosen. There's no need for fear. Your world needs help. We will help before it is too late. You are not prepared to understand. We will return again soon.
Oh, man, I believe this. 100%.
He says that the same voice came to him a month later, and he says that all his fear has left him. He says he wants to go to that world, whatever it is they came from, he says. I don't think they'd carry me if they couldn't bring me back. And if they ever decide to destroy this world, they might save a few of the people. I'd like to think I'm one of those. So he just doesn't want to be burned up with everybody.
Yeah.
So he requested and passed a lie detector test. Parker suffered a breakdown and was briefly hospitalized.
As you would.
And then both men admitted to further contact since and no longer had any fear of the beings. So that's the story of the Pascagoula UFO incident and the general 1973 UFO flap.
The flap. How do you spell Pascagoula?
Pascagoula.
Okay, good, because I was going to Google it, but I don't know, I wouldn't get it spelled right on the first try. You know what? I believe all of it.
Yeah.
I think I believe it.
Yeah.
But where are they now?
No kidding.
If our planet needs them so bad, like, God dang it, where the hell are
these
aliens?
Planet needs you more than ever now.
God dang aliens, where are they? Help us. Something crazy is happening.
Yeah, really.
Aliens.
We're going to do some major damage soon.
Friggin' aliens. Hurry up. Help us out.
What's next, babe?
You think the aliens are responsible for that fast food item that's like it's a hot dog, but the bun is made out of chicken?
That's disgusting.
You heard of that?
No, only humans could come up with that.
Yeah,
trust me.
It's called the, I can't remember what it's called, but it's like, it's like chicken with a hot dog
that's
in it.
That's the worst thing I've ever heard. Only humans come up with
it's
that.
It's delicious. It's the double down dog, I think. Is what it's called. I think the aliens
what
are responsible.
What restaurant establishment has that item?
I want to say...
probably Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Yeah, I want to say KFC or Arby's or something. Or
why would you eat that?
Or Popeye's Chicken or something.
Why would you want to eat that?
Oh, it's delicious looking.
Oh, that's
disgusting.
Because
who needs bread when you can have chicken as the bread?
Fried chicken.
Fried chicken as the bun.
That is so ridiculous.
Yeah. October 20th, 1973. The Rolling Stones take over the Billboard number one spot with NJ.
Ugh, I don't like that one. Well, it's a ballad, so I guess it's not a surprise.
Yeah, it was a ballad, but out of all ballads, I think I like this one. But this was there was speculation that this song was about David Bowie's first wife, Angela.
Oh. Well, I know David Bowie and Mick Jagger, I think, had some gay loving going on.
Yeah, they did bang each other
in
the butt, and they 69'd it while standing up and doing curls.
No, they did not.
October 27th, 1973, Gladys Knight and the Pimps.
Yes.
Not the Pimps.
The Pips.
Midnight Train to Georgia.
That's a good song.
This is a great song, but I did some research and I found some interesting stuff out about this song that I had no idea.
All right, hit it. Sakatumi.
So this is Gladys Knight's signature song.
Yeah.
But this was originally written and performed by Jim Weatherly under the title Midnight Plane to Houston.
Oh, jeez.
So it wasn't Midnight Train to Georgia. It was the Midnight Plane to Houston, which he recorded.
That doesn't even sound good.
Yeah, it's stupid, but it was based on a conversation he had.
Yeah.
With.
Yeah.
Farrah Fawcett.
What?
Yep.
Boy, it all. It's like just one incestuous pool out there in Hollywood, isn't it?
Isn't it crazy that he had a phone conversation with Farrah Fawcett and he used Fawcett and his friend Lee Majors, who she just started dating, as like kind of characters of the song. And he said that she said, oh yeah, I gotta take a midnight plane to Houston on the phone. Like she was talking on the phone, and that he got off the phone and wrote that song.
Really?
And then it eventually got involved in a midnight train to Georgia. Thursday, November 1st, 1973, Randy Macho Man Savage debuted in wrestling as the Spider. He wasn't Macho Man, and he
the
wasn't
the Spider.
Savage. He was called the Spider, but he debuted. A lot of people don't know this, but he debuted in wrestling during the off season of another sport that he played.
Oh, football?
He was still playing. Oh, baseball. Remember I told you he was a Cincinnati?
Oh, that's right.
So he was, at this time, he was in Sarasota, I believe, or he was on a, oh, I looked all this up and I didn't write it all down.
Oh,
he was,
thank God you didn't write it down.
He was in the minor leagues
We'd
for
have to
a
listen
team,
through it.
A team, the,
who cares?
Bats or something. No, what is the team? He was, anyway, he was playing minor league baseball on one of his, and you can find his stats on 73 and 74. That's the off season between the 73 and 74 season. He made his debut as the Spider. When this is before he had quit wrestling, it was the Paw Tucket, I don't know, some team in Florida he was on.
All right, next.
Yep, so Randy Savage, wrestling. We talked about wrestling. Randy
next.
Savage, the Spider. A lot of people don't know that. Also on that same day, Maud was on.
Okay.
And Maud gives Walter an electric organ as an anniversary gift. Unfortunately, he plays it all the time and has no musical talent. And did you know
electric organs?
Do you know who played her husband on Maud?
No.
The same guy from The Jerk, who says, "Check away, Nathan R. Johnson." He's checking his oil and he invents the OptiGrab for him because
I remember.
Damn these glasses, son. Yeah. Okay, I damn thee. And he invents the OptiGrab.
That's right.
That's her husband in that show. So. On November 10th, 1973, Eddie Kendricks takes over the Billboard charts with "Keep On Truckin'." You know that song?
I know that. I know that lingo. Temptations rain, I know that
I'm
saying.
For your love through sleep,
I just picture
snow,
that.
I'm truckin'.
I just picture that guy with his big foot coming forward.
Keep on truckin'. Yeah, it became a big thing.
Yep.
Eddie Kendricks was 2 years deep into a solo career following his bitter split from the Temptations in 1971. When his former bandmates went on to record hits such as Superstar, Remember How You Got Where You Are, which was a reported jab at Kendricks and fellow ex-Temptation David Ruffin. And he included a jab at his former bandmates with the lyrics, "In old Temptations, rain I'm ducking, for your love through sleet or snow I'm trucking."
Okay.
Keep on trucking. And then Saturday, November 17th, 1973, Richard Nixon gave his famous "I am not a crook" speech.
I am not a crook.
I am not a crook. I have earned every cent. In all of the years of my public life, I've never obstructed justice. People have got to know whether or not their president is a crook. Well, I'm not a crook. I have earned everything I've got.
That's pretty good, babe.
Yeah, you like that?
That was a pretty good impression there.
If this one goes down, they have to impeach me. Tuesday, November 20th, 1973, after the drummer of The Who passed out during a live performance in 1973, the lead singer asked if anyone could fill in.
Oh, my God.
At a concert. Can anybody play drums?
Oh, my God.
A 19-year-old Scott Halpin stepped up to the plate. They invited him on stage, and he finished the remaining three songs.
Oh, my God. That's funny.
Halpin, who had recently moved to the area from Muscatine, Iowa, was there with a friend using tickets they had bought from a scalper.
Oh!
They arrived at the show 13 hours early to get good seats.
Boy, that paid off, didn't it?
Yep. The Who opened the show with three of their earlier hits before launching into material from Quadrophenia, playing 11 of the album's 17 songs, and then continuing on to other hits. About 70 minutes into the show, drummer Keith Moon...
70 minutes in?
70 minutes God. Into the show. Drummer Keith Moon, who banged that Connie that we were talking about earlier, whose fondness for drugs and alcohol was legendary, began to falter during Won't Get Fooled Again. And he slumped over his drum kit and was helped off by roadies while the others finished the song without him. Backstage, Moon was placed in a shower by roadies in an attempt to revive him.
Jeez.
Their efforts worked. An injection of cortisone got him back on stage after approximately a 30-minute delay.
Jeez. So during that 30 minutes is when this...
At this time, Halpin and his friend were at left of the stage, and his friend Mike Denise began noisily telling the security staff, "He can play!" In truth, Halpin had not played in a year. But Denise made enough commotion that he had attracted the concert's promoter, Bill Graham. And he says, "Graham just looked at me and said, 'Can you do it?' And I said, 'Yes, straight out. Townsend and Daltrey look around and they're as surprised as I am because Graham put me up there.' Halpin was given a shot of brandy for his nerves before sitting on his first drum set since leaving Iowa. Then I got really focused, and Townsend said to me, "I'm going to lead you. I'm going to cue you." Townsend shook his hand as he sat down. Daltrey introduced Halpin as Scott and went straight into the riff of Smokestack Lightning.
So then after 30 minutes, they put Keith Moon back out there?
Yeah, he came back out there. Afterwards, Scott was taken backstage along with his friend Mike and given a Who concert jacket, which Halpin said was stolen later that evening. Despite Moon's collapse,
what a bummer.
The concert lasted around the same length as most Who gigs at the time.
Oh, wow.
How crazy of a story is that?
That is a crazy story,
1973,
babe.
1973, baby.
Mm-hmm.
And then November 24th, 1973, Ringo Starr takes over the Billboard charts with Photograph. He and George Harrison wrote it together. They began writing it on a luxury yacht in the south of France in May 1971. Starr had hired a yacht.
Yeah, I know it.
Now it sounds familiar.
Yeah. It's a photograph.
Yeah, I guess you would know it, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's easily forgotten.
Mm.
Then we're in December. The Carpenters take over with Top of the World.
On the top of the world, looking down on creation, and the only explanation I can find. That's another one that
you
was in
a
my
good voice, babe.
That's the other one that was in my music
class.
Music
like
class.
Elementary
book.
School.
Yeah, elementary school textbook.
Yeah, that sounds like something you have.
That was in there.
They originally intended to only be an album cut. However, the country singer Lynn Anderson covered the song, and it became a number two hit in the country charts. So then they reconsidered and then released it themselves. Folk songs are always better if you're really high on weed. December 15th, 1973, Charlie Rich took over the Billboard charts with The Most Beautiful Girl. But so Countrypolitan is a different kind of Nashville sound.
Countrypolitan.
The most
beautiful girl in the world. So 70s. He's so 70s.
Just 70s.
Sweet.
Anyway, it's garbage.
Yeah.
I hate country music.
I know, but that's so 70s, that song.
Yeah, that's pretty 70s sounding. Monday, December 19th, Johnny Carson joked about there being a toilet paper shortage on The Tonight Show.
Oh, boy. And then everybody freaked out.
People did not realize it was a joke, and they panicked, and they bought as much toilet paper as they could, which actually caused a toilet paper shortage.
Oh, man.
But Johnny Carson went on the air several nights later and explained that there was no shortage and apologized for scaring the public. Unfortunately, people saw all the empty shelves in the stores, so the stampede continued.
Jeez. Stampede. I like to picture a stampede for toilet paper.
I gotta wipe my ass!
You know? People
I gotta are just wipe being, my ass!
People are just being trampled.
I got diarrhea! I need toilet paper. My favorite name for toilet paper is shit tickets.
I know it is.
And then December 29th, 1973, the final number one song of 1973 is Jim Croce, Time in a Bottle.
If I could save time in a bottle, the first thing that I'd like to do.
This is sad.
Yeah.
Jim Croce wrote the lyrics.
It's sad because he's dead, and he sings about there never seems to be enough time.
Not only that,
do the things we
you're
would
right.
Do.
He says that, but he wrote the lyrics after his wife Ingrid told him she was pregnant.
Oh.
In December 1970.
Oh.
And it appeared on his 1972 ABC album, You Don't Mess Around with Jim. ABC originally did not intend to release the song as a single, but when Croce was killed in a plane crash in September 1973,
yep.
The song's lyrics dealing with mortality and the wish to have more time had additional resonance.
Yes, it does.
The song subsequently received a large amount of airplay as an album track and demand for a single release built.
Wow.
That's sad. It makes that song way more sad.
Way more sad.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a beautiful song.
On that note, we have to kick Chuck Berry the hell out of here.
You don't want me to do toys? I guess it's kind of late for toys. Oh. There wasn't a lot that was...
Do you have a couple highlights?
Silly Putty was a big one. Stretches like taffy and bounces like rubber.
And you remember you could like stick it to the newspaper?
Yes, that was the only thing that was good for.
It wasn't really good for anything else.
And then the Zip Fit skates for shoes. Indoor and outdoor skates with the adjustable leather strap, push-pull adjustable frame. Remember these? Rubber wheels work outside and easier on floors. Toe pieces with foam rubber to hold tight even works well with sneakers.
What are these?
They're
you tied
the roller skates you put on your tennis shoes.
Yeah, roller skates you tied to your shoes. Yeah, I had those.
And they're adjustable, like you can make them longer or shorter.
Big metal ones, we had those. They were
such dangerous toys.
I hurt myself every single time.
Yep, yeah, me too.
And I was thinking of the silly putty. It was good for putting your penis into it.
I'm leaving now.
I just ruined the podcast.
Good night, everybody.
Good night, everybody. Get out of here, Chuck Berry. Get your dick out of the silly putty.
Yep. Get out of here, Chuck Berry.
We'll see you next
episode. Take it away, Matt Truman.
This is episode 36.
Find his album.
American Timelines is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network. For more information, go to queencitypodcastnetwork.com.